My name is Bill Strelo, and as Jody mentioned someplace today, I am what is called the village philosopher. That's what they call me. I'm not sure what that all means, but in talking with people who have done that over the past few years at different times, it has something to do with being the village idiot, village atheist, the village whatever, and Jody and Ingrid know me well enough that I probably can do some of that. As I understand it, these forums that gather Monday through Saturday night at 9 o'clock are designed to pick up on various happenings, points of discussion, differences that occur during the teaching sessions that occur throughout the day during the week. They're also to include perhaps certain concerts on a given evening to replace some discussions, but essentially a chance for the community to get together to discuss maybe at a greater length some of the things that just creep up during some of the sessions. So it's for all of us at the community of Holden Village to speak our minds, to nuance certain things that we hear, and perhaps also to react in ways that we have chosen to react before to some of the presentations that have been given. I look forward as a time to have the differences that we have amongst ourselves addressed so that perhaps the similarities that we share amongst each other can be discovered and celebrated. So I ask you to help me with this during the week, to help me identify what's surfacing for you as you listen to some of the presentations that are given. Helps find the threads that go through the presentations and through the discussions. And if there's a specific request that you would like to have addressed during these 9 p.m. Forums, please let me know. This morning when John Schramm was talking on the disarmed lifestyle around the notion of gentle justice as the central theme of his spirituality, we paid a great deal of attention to the world in which we live and the world in which we try to act out our lives and values as Christians. What we want to do tonight, and what we want to help have you help us do, is to talk about that world from the standpoint of the media. How does the media inform us, lift up our prejudices, distort our views, distort our notions, and how do our values as Christians, and we all have them, how do our values as Christians, how are they shaped by the media? How are they distorted? And how do we keep them from really letting us address the world as we would want to address it as people of God? And the person who we've asked to lead our presentation in terms of the input is Jody Kretzmann, who you know as one of the co-directors of the programming for Holden this week, actually for the summer, excuse me. And Jody has a long history of informing people about the communities that they live in and how their values are shaped. And so I'd like Jody to lead us off.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Let me just do a few minutes with you about my own view of the media. In a sort of confessional style, I'm almost as embarrassed as Dan Spencer was earlier tonight when he confessed his former allegiance to Schuller, that I am a former journalist. And so I will put that hat on at the moment and just say a few things about my own view of the media out of practice that I engaged in for a few years. And I know there's some other journalists around, at least of some note. Jan Larson's over there. May want to leap in at some point, probably some others that I don't know about yet. I'm concerned just to lay out a few minutes of my worries about mass news media as impediments to citizenship as impediments to our being effective actors in our world. It seems to me that a whole series of images are going to be presented to us this week about the ways in which the world is changing. John Schramm is going to continue to talk with us about the active, reconciling, nonviolent lifestyle. And Mary Chandler is going to be talking with us more about changing images of God that reflect a changing world. Karen Bloomquist clearly is going to be talking about the ways in which massive shifts in the economy and the structure of work change how we think about justice and how we think about church. James Spencer has already begun challenging us on changes in our perceptions of sexuality. And we'll do so later also in the week in foreign relations areas. And of course, Rosemary Ruther is with us this week, who will be talking with us about changes in perceptions of male and female relationships. My question tonight at the beginning of the week for us to think about is, how helpful are the mass media, particularly the mass news media, in guiding us in ways of thinking about these incredible changes in our society? I think they're not very helpful, but I don't think they're very helpful for some subtle, I think more subtle reasons. I don't like simplistic media bashing. I think that it's too easily entered into. I think everybody gets too much enjoyment out of it. I certainly do occasionally. I don't think there's any kind of a media conspiracy. I don't think that the media are filled with bad people. I don't think that they're filled with stupid people. I do think that because of their structure and their way of viewing the world, that they don't tell us what it is we need to know to be active citizens. And for Lutherans, who grow up with a tradition of the church not being real helpful on that point, too, it's a double whammy. I want to say a few things about how the media interpret the real world. Right? We've got real world on one hand. We all live it all the time. Our lives are the stuff of the real world, filled with events. Obviously, not all of those events get recorded back to us when we are also then wearing our hats as consumers of news. Right? In the middle are some institutions that we know about as media. Particularly, I'm interested tonight in just saying a few words about news media. They mediate, they sort, they select, right, from the real world and give it to us back again as consumers. They certainly do not mirror the real world. Right? They do select. How? Just a few brief comments on how. First, under how they define the news. Let's just stick with news for a minute here. Second, how they gather the news. And third, how they report the news. Think for a minute about just a few of the characteristics of what is news. How do news media define the news? Let me just tick off a few. News is what is new. Think about all of the things in your life that are not new, that are continuous, that have a past that's important, right, that are part of a context. Already, 98% of the world is eliminated from a definition of news. Variation on that. News is often defined as what is exceptional, not what is normal. Maybe what it is that we are most importantly drawn to understand about our world and about the deep structural changes in it are the patterns, are the underlying kinds of plate tectonic, to use the geological term, movements in our world and in our economy and in our society. Media are not helpful that way, news media aren't, often, because they're after the extraordinary and not the ordinary. You cannot understand crime by reading news media stories about the most gory crime. It's the most exceptional thing, not the most ordinary that we hear about. New, exceptional. Events. Media report events. Think about how much of the world is not made up of events. Is made up of relationships. Is made up of conditions. Is made up of structures that really aren't events. poverty's not news. Riots are news. News is new, exceptional, event-oriented. News is often formulaic. That is, if you're a news editor and you've got lots of stuff coming across your desk every day, one of the things you want to do is to make use of all of the received categories you have for understanding the world. And if you get something on your desk that does not fit into a set formula that you have for understanding the world, you're not going to print it. You won't. Examples. Hero stories. Stories of individual heroism, right? You write a good one of those, and you're a reporter, you absolutely know it's going to get by the news editor on page one. More importantly, maybe, for understanding world events, formula, East-West conflict. Everything that's foreign news has to, for the most part, fit into a preset formula that says the major thing that's going on in the world today is conflict between the United States and the USSR. So what if the news that 98% of the story in Nicaragua or El Salvador has, surprisingly enough, to do with the history of Nicaragua or the history of El Salvador? Never mind. Let's go to the State Department and get a statement. And let's go to the Russian embassy and get a statement. And frame what's going on in Central America in the East-West formula. If we can't fit it in, the heck with it. And the reporters in Nicaragua and El Salvador know that. There are exceptions to all of these. But I'm trying to warn us about some ways in which our world comes back to us. News events. New, exceptional, they're events, they're formulaic. Often in the United States, uniquely it seems to me in the world press, events have to be, or news has to be, personalizable in order to be news. Right? Real hard to think in a flashy way about the incredibly complex dynamics of changing relationships between men and women in the society. It is a lot harder to do that than to designate a symbol in the person of a person for, say, women's lib. Right? So Gloria Steinem gets named. Or maybe sometimes Rosemary Ruther gets named. Or somebody gets named as a personalized symbol of something that is much, much more complex. We see this most a personalizable necessity for news. We see it most, I suppose, in political campaigns, but it happens a whole lot in other parts of the world as well. Okay, those are characteristics of news. The question I've been trying to address here very briefly, how do people in the news business think about the real world in a way that shapes that world, reshapes it, sorts it for us as consumers? They do a couple of other things in the gathering of the news. Most news is gathered by, as you all know, I'm sure, a beat system. That is, reporters get assigned to a certain topic area, a certain institution, a certain set of questions in the society, and they cover that. This has some advantages to it. It is possible that reporters may actually know something about what they're writing about if they have a beat. Not always true, but sometimes true. And it's also possible, if they've got a beat, that they are less likely, if something happens in that institution, if they're covering the State Department, the Pentagon, the local police station, if something happens within the purview of that institution, they'll know about it, right? So those are pretty good advantages. But there are some disadvantages that I think are important for us to know about. It seems to me that we ought to know that if we are journalists covering an institution, and that's what we do every day, that the one thing we know about is that we have to go back there the next morning. Right? That we're going to be talking to those same people who are giving us our story today, tomorrow. Right? There is a dance of agreement between the reporter and the institution or set of events being covered, the people being covered, that does not go out of a boundary of disagreement. Right? Do you ever wonder why reporters begin to cover the State Department and suddenly begin to sound like the State Department or sound like the Pentagon? Why a Marvin Kell can leap from 20 years in CBS News over to being this the spokesperson for the State Department. It's because you get totally imbued with the point of view of the world that that particular institution carries, right? So reporters get taken over by the viewpoint of the institutions that they cover. And their views of the world, the reporters' views of the world, become the views of those institutions. Finally, particularly in the United States, a word on the reporting of news, particularly as it's taught in traditional journalism. Schools and courses, you all know about it. The basic formula for reporting news is what's called the inverted pyramid. Right? You all picture an inverted pyramid? All the facts are at the top. All the interpretation and contextualization is at the bottom. What this is an easy way for an editor to cut stories. It's back before computers and newspapers, when you really had to depend on the editor to cut the story. And what the editor could do is cut out all the stuff from the bottom up. She or he did not have to think about what they were doing to the story. And they could cut it all the way up to the top two paragraphs and get all the pertinent facts in. What that does to a reporter after a while is it gets you thinking that interpretation, contextualization, understanding is a secondary matter. What's really important are the surface facts. Okay? All of that is multiplied when you get into the electronic media by the immense demands for good visuals, particularly on television, which we'll talk some more about. Well, in summary, what does this do? It seems to me we get a view of our world through the media, which is very peculiar. It is a world largely made up of disconnected events which are both independent of each other and detached from any history. They are events that are often attached to people, individual people, and therefore find no communal meaning. And in fact, they are events that don't mean anything, that don't add up to even a semi-coherent whole, are totally out of context and out of history. And finally, what I think that means is that they are events that are absolutely incapable of being affected by active citizenship. There's nothing we can do with those kinds of events. Citizen activity affecting our society, bringing our values to play on our institutions, requires sustained interest, growing knowledge and sophistication about the areas that we want to be active in, a sense of deeper causality, right, about what's going on in the areas that we're interested in, a sense of a broader rationality and a context into which the events fit. None of those things, I would argue, are the mass media at all helpful in doing this? And therefore, we've got a problem. That's all.
When I was in college, a long while back, it was after, at San Francisco State University, during the strike, when Hayakawa abolished the newspaper.
Kill the messenger. It's a historically resonant way of dealing with bad news.
That's right. And later on, a year or so after the strike, a number of people started a new paper and called it Zenger's, after John Peter Zenger, who some of you may remember was the editor of the paper during the revolution, or right after it, that began to print what he considered the truth and ultimately got himself in a whole series of problems, but it began the basis for the First Amendment. And I always was brought up on the notion that the journalists, the Fourth and Fifth Estate, that help us recognize the truth, and yet you have said that they are, in a sense, conspirators. Do the very, very opposite of that. Do not help us find the truth, to sift through the information. The question then is, what and how do we begin to identify and converse with one another about what is happening out there. If in fact the bodies of the stories are cut out, as you said, how not to be taken over, interpretation is cut out, and it's just limited to the general facts that everybody can understand, how are we to evolve into a citizenry that shares values, or evolve into a church, a public church, who understands its values? Question directed to you. Why don't you, anyone else?
Well, let me just say a word about that, and I hope you can open it up. I certainly don't mean to imply that, I think I said, I don't think there are any conspiracies involved in the coverage of the news. I think that, you know, every profession has its peculiar way of looking at the world and a peculiar set of lenses in a language that develops. Certainly clergy do, among others. I think that what is particularly... what's particularly interesting about the news media in that regard, though, is that they do, to some degree, pretend to mirror the real world and to be aids in our understanding and interpretation of the real world. And it just does seem to me that when one understands the norms that are at work, a lot of deviation from all these norms, but the basic norms that are at work, that we really have to be very skeptical about those claims. And one way, there are two brief pieces of advice for people who would be citizens in a mass media society. One is learn to read between the lines of newspapers. I always find it helpful to look at every story, and I do it automatically, and know other people who do too, who are journalists, and ask not what is the story about, but what did this journalist do with her or his day? How was your day, journalist? And usually the answer is, well, I went to a press conference. So what you're getting is the flack from some institution that's speaking through the mouth of the journalist. You know, learn to spot the sort of in-between-the-lines stuff like that. And of course, the other thing is to read all kinds of alternative press sources. Both European press, I think, are very helpful, and virtually every issue that one could possibly get involved in as a citizen has a rich growth of alternative media around it, which does, in fact, do the interpretive job.
The European ones function the same way, you think? The European papers function the same way?
Other people can comment. My own view is that the European press is very different from the U.S. press. And that, you know, so there's certainly some structural samenesses about it. And in fact, as electronic journalism gets more and more global, there are more and more similarities between the European press and the U.S. But in print journalism, if you read the great European papers, Le Monde and others, you really do see a different style. They've never been married to the inverted pyramid. They do send reporters out for 10 days, 2 weeks to do a long interpretive piece. You're much likelier to see more often, not that U.S. papers don't do it at all, but more often in the European press, almost an essay, a magazine kind of essay about a story.
I don't want to escalate this and get off the track of the ordinary problems of journalism, but I do think there are conspiracies in reporting the news. There's no question about that. The Senate investigation with the CIA and the FBI 10 years ago, there was quite a bit of documentation about the way that particularly the CIA planned stories, not only in the foreign press, which you might expect them to do as one of their kinds of covert activities, but also in the American press. And the way they do it is to place it with a foreign news service that is then picked up by an American press, so that the story circulates in some way. And there was a recent example in the New York Times that suggests to me some kind of conspiracy, and you could make your own mind up if you looked at the documentation. About 2 weeks ago, Daniel Ortega and his wife spoke at Riverside Church. The place was packed. He spoke for at least a half an hour. He was extremely eloquent. I came skeptical, frankly, and I was persuaded. He gave an eloquent, detailed, factual speech with a lot of good arguments in it. no doubt to the advantage of his country, as any leader would do. But essentially his purpose was to plead with the religious community who were out in force to intervene with their government to stop the war in Nicaragua. There were a lot of television cameras there. There were press. I don't know what was on television. I didn't go home and watch it. But I did look the time. He was in New York for almost a week, I think. He spoke to the UN Security Council and some other places. I only found about four things that week in the time. The article on his appearance at Riverside Church quoted about half a sentence of that half-hour eloquent speech. And it wasn't a particularly pertinent sentence at all. The whole article focused on how attracted he and his wife were, what designer glasses he had on. It looked good. I mean, that's part of what they're doing. Walking through Central Park, the picture of him on the front page of the Times, surrounded by their security officers. That was the effect. That was not only the effect in the church. One had the impression of serious people with some integrity who were really desperate to persuade us to get out of the country. Well, anyway, the other things that were in the Times was a report on the UN Security Council speech. There were about two sentences reporting an error, so hardly anything of substance. The third thing was there was a show on television which I missed, but it was on the mosquito Indian problem in Nicaragua. They showed that on Channel 13 during the week when Ortega was in New York. It was very negative about the government, and it was kind, I thought, rather well. And there were a couple of other things I can't recall right now like that, that led me to believe that that news was managed very carefully. Not to the discredit of the Times, particularly, because I think that would have happened elsewhere, too. And about, I don't know, 2 days after the disaster, there was an America's Watch item on the op-ed page that was about human rights abuses in El Salvador. So there was some kind of balance in the newspaper. But to me, that suggests some kind of a conspiracy with a familiar configuration that has been documented, but that the Congress is no longer particularly concerned about because the watch committees that have been set up in the Conference Center have essentially become, like the reporters who report on them, arms of the institutions that they're overseeing.
Let me say one thing back to that. Everybody should know Jan Larson, who joined the teaching staff today from Rutgers in New York. Jan has been an editor and a writer for the Christian Century for a number of years and certainly knows the journalism scene out there. But Jan, I would understand that not in conspiratorial terms. I would understand that as part of a clear example of that one of the few growth industries one could point to in the last 10 years in the United States, and that's public relations, right? I mean, there are now more recent journalism school graduates going to work for major public and private corporations and not going to work for journalism outlets, right, that there are going to work for journalism outlets. So that what you have is just a mushrooming of people whose only job is to manipulate the media, mm-hmm. right? And they are concentrated in the most powerful institutions in the society. You can pay them real well, better newspapers can. Mm-hmm. I think probably what you saw in New York was the work of the growing army of media manipulators working for a variety of institutions, public and private, that managed to, get the New York Times to do exactly what they want that week. That's what they get paid for.
Well, who's watchdogging in the New York Times? It seems that kind of thing is curtailed. I mean, you hear a lot about managed news from the government and the Kennedy administration on down to the present one.
If you talk to editors today, one of the things they will tell you is their biggest problem is they don't know what to do with the army of media manipulators who are out there now sending them stuff. Because a lot of it's very well done, very slick stuff, very good stuff. It's easy to do. It's easy to print. And they are demanding. They're demanding of editors' time. They're demanding of reporters' time. I think it's a problem. I don't think the New York Times knows what to do about it. You know, let alone the Louisville Courier-Journal, Seattle.
How much of the problem that you talk about do you think is based on a profit motive?
Well, these are all profit-making hopefully from the owner's point of view, profit-making institution.
Right, but the way in which they present news, the type of news that they present, the amount of it that they present, the, it seems an ever-increasing amount of newspapers is devoted to advertising, feature articles, things that are going to grab people's attention.
Yeah. The formula basically in the print media is that the, in the daily newspaper world is that 60% of your space has to be advertised if you're going to turn a profit. 40% but left for the so-called news hole, and the news hole includes a lot of fluff, including news. I mean, a brief answer. My own view is that the business side of the electronic media controls the news in the electronic media much more than the business side does in the print media. Because every reporter in the electronic media looks for those ratings all the time. I mean, I don't know any reporters that don't in the electronic media. And they come in overnight now. You know who watched your news program last night. And you know whether or not the top three stories that you featured on the ads were the ones that drew viewers or not. And that's really going to determine a lot of what you do this afternoon. There's not that direct day-to-day pressure on the print media report to reflect the business end of things, but there's still profit making there.
Seems to me that what sells advertising in either print media is circulation, and the visual media is number of viewers. To what extent do you think the public actually is getting what they want?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, other people must have opinions about that.
Now, how are your beliefs, or how are our beliefs formed by what we hear or read?
Or how is what we read formed by what our beliefs already are?
How are our beliefs massaged?
It seems to me that an awful lot of what you get in the newspaper is sensationalism that has no real intrinsic value to the individual reader. What really great interest is it to me that out of cut away there was a family quarrel and the husband ended up shooting the wife? It really doesn't make any, it was no threat to me because it was a family quarrel, and why do I need to know in a newspaper? The newspaper apparently believes, and I'm just a fictional thing, but the newspaper in Seattle or whatever apparently believes this kind of stuff will get people's attention and they'll buy the newspaper. Or they'll keep turning on to the radio station, the TV station because of it. It seems to me like an awful lot of it really is not really pertinent to the individuals that are receiving it.
I think it's pertinent. That lets you know that you shouldn't, you've got to be awful careful if you're going to interfere in anybody's family quarrel, and lets you know how tempted to get out of the country. Maybe, you know, I think that's dying, kind of thing.
Yep.
How many of them do we need?
How good do you feel is the reporting? I watched in Latino America on public television. And there's no advertising version. Do you feel it's good reporting?
Well, I think McNeil Lehrer is an exceptionally good, within the limits of television, they do marvelous things. You know, they also get about 0.5 of 1% of the viewers. I mean, it's not really over in the corner. It's the same way with the National Public Radio, which I think does an awful lot of good reporting. But it's not, in one way or another, it's sort of, it's really at the edge of mass media. I suppose it's the edge of mass media. But I think they do nice things within the... I wouldn't watch McNeil Lehrer, though, either, as my major source of understanding as a citizen. If I wanted to understand something so that I could act on it, so that I knew enough to be able to be an effective former of my society, I certainly wouldn't depend on even the best of the electronic media.
If we buy the newspapers to be informed, if we listen to the radio or TV to be informed, then we've got to have some kind of a filter system. And I'm not sure that at the present time most of us are able to filter anymore.
Amen.
Or what to filter. And that, it gets kind of scary at times, especially when, you know, the TV news comes on and like, what's the most sensational thing they can show you? I don't care whether it's national, international, it's the most scariest thing that they can bring up. And I used to enjoy reading the newspaper. I don't even get any fun out of it, including the comments.
I think that's a terrific and significant point. I mean, what it leads to is that the most intelligent sort of receivers of the news in the society turn into total skeptics, right? And everything is relative. Right? Everything needs to be doubted. There's no possibility of gaining enough insight to act on anything. And you just, it's an invitation to immobilization. Very frightening. That's an invitation to totalitarianism as well.
In fact, as you mentioned, McNeil Lehrer, I watch that regularly, but that, because they try to be so balanced, that in a sense is almost an invitation to kind of neutrality.
Well, that's right. The pretension to objectivity in the news media is an interesting sort of another angle on the whole thing. We haven't talked about it at all, but every story has two sides to it.
Yeah.
Two and only two, right? Never 14 like the real world usually comes in, right? Walt Stevens has this wonderful poem, right? 13 ways of viewing the blackbird. And that's more like what reality is. But in the media, no, reality has two sides to it. You know, often it's USSR, but every story comes that way. And the way you get objectivity in the media is you ask somebody from each side to say a sentence about the event in question. I think that's objectivity. My goodness, that's really good. I'm sure I understand it.
I think one thing that bothers me the most is the way it's delivered on TV. You'll start out, you know, they're smiling. Here it is, it's August 11th, you know. And then there's this horrible murder, or a child's been kidnapped, you know. And then they go to something that's really light and airy and doesn't give you enough time to feel what was really wrong. So I worry about that.
And again, what does it do then to the viewer to change moods every 20 seconds?
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, what it probably does is...
Yeah, you know, you feel like, well, someone was murdered out there.
That's right.
A lot, you know?
It flattens our emotions.
Yeah, let's
right?
hurry up and hear what the sonics are doing.
I think that it's good thing that we're looking at what the scriptures, the gospel mean, the good news. And I think that in the media, just like everything else, that we have to respond to the call to these people set apart. And I don't mean isolated or not in the world, but not of it. And one of the things that I've watched my 7-year-old, having had two other children who are almost 20, watch this little one come up. We don't let him watch the news because he gets such a frightened view of the world. And you know, it's not like we're trying to exclude him from knowing that he doesn't need to know a lot of that at this point. And one of the things I just realized when you were talking was our church, which is a large church, publishes its own newspaper. And it's the whole thing is just about 10 pages, but there's story after story of resurrection, of hope and change and power in the individual's lives. And one of the themes of what seems to go into illness, cancer especially, is helplessness and hopelessness. And, you know, the Seattle Times is an exercise in futility and hopelessness. And I seldom read that anymore. I want to know about the world, but not on those terms. And if I expose myself to that and my family to that regularly, I'm building darkness. But I don't want to be misunderstood as trying to protect myself from reality. But people, you know, in the times of, what was it, the crusade, that what was the wandering minstrel that went around telling the news they went to travel from town to town? I feel like that's what we're supposed to do. And in my work, I work with the therapy, and a lot of people are futility, and I tell the stories of hope from one family to another. Because people can go forward if they have a message of hope, but I don't think I'm going to read it.
What I was going to say, we have isolated ourselves out of having intelligent successes. And I, when I say that, that almost 100% of the time, the person I say it to, it'll come up in some context, usually about violence. And we don't have one because we don't want to see all that violence. And they'll say, oh, we don't watch it very often. And there's something kind of funny in that. Maybe the 99% of the people that have television set feel guilty watching it, and I was wondering why they felt guilty watching it.
Do people feel guilty about watching television? I think, though, that at some point in time, our Christian upbringing has to be, as I said before, the filter for all of this. I mean, at some point in time, whether we bring up our children isolated or unisolated, they have to have a value system that can deal with that. And I don't think that isolating them entirely from life as it is going to assist them when they unloose the apron strings or whatever it happens to be. We have too much of that already. We confirm them and they disappear. Hopefully to reappear in 5 years. But
I'm not a parent, but I'm a teacher of college students. And I worry a lot about their own, consumption of the media. And in the past, I've done different things in freshman composition, which is my big shot. Talk about media, and I haven't found a good approach yet. I'm working on it still, but I do think that the thing not to do is simply to teach the citizens about the media. That isn't enough. There has to be, whatever issue it is, media or nuclear arms or whatever it is, there has to be that vision of hope and that motivation to be an active citizen and not simply to be a critical consumer. And part of that comes, I think, through the example, this is in the parents, but the example of parents reading other sorts of information. You simply have to do that. And otherwise, you really scrap without being eligible citizen. And so I guess I would invite people to comment on what they do as parents or as teachers about teaching people to be better consumers of news and users of information as Christians. Or maybe we don't do it.
Well, I've done that with all six of my kids. We'd watch news and they'd be in there. If there was a commercial on, it was absolutely telling a stupid statement type of thing, we'd laugh about it. It was ridiculous, that they're trying to sell cars with sex appeal or something, instead of how good the car is. And when it comes to news items, too, we get to where we just pick holes in it and, like you say, read between the lines and say, well, if we know what they're getting at, this is what they're really getting at. And in other words, what I did is I trained my kids indirectly to question what was coming over the booth to. The newspaper was in such a big thing.
It does seem to me that both families and churches can be places where a context is set for the news, where the news is the occasion for ongoing conversation, interpretation, alternative ways of thinking about it. That's something families and churches can do.
Yeah, it seems to me that that's also rather new in America, at least in American democracy. You started this out by talking about citizenship. That was a part of it. And yet, more often than not, I've always heard and been a part of churches who don't talk about citizenship but discipleship, as if the two cannot have some sort of a stance of agreement. with one another. And what are the values you talked about that Christians purport to have that can be effective in a democracy? How do we be better citizens? How can we be better citizens beyond just electoral politics, given our values as disciples? And churches, you talked about media mediate the news. Well, churches are supposed to be mediating institutions. Do we do that very well? We do that at Holden, I think, a little bit here. But do we do that back home? Do communities of people gather to mediate, to really look at, as he said, the things that have been locked out, that really we only are left with the propaganda or the reaction to propaganda?
We thought we'd learn a lot more by reading the letters.
It's the first place I look when I get the copy of the Luther thing.
You know, one of the things that I find a lot of difficulties in trying to follow a life of discipleship, I pointed one out earlier this morning, and that was the business about having personal standards. But I didn't know, I really didn't know if those personal standards would apply at a national and international level. Is it workable at that level? I know it's workable at a personal level. And in the same field here, we know from Scripture what Jesus said, that we're supposed to fill our minds with that which is good and positive and wholesome and all that. In other words, it's the old computer thing, garbage in, garbage out. If all you do is you take garbage into your mind, garbage is going to come out in your life. So if we fill our mind with that which is good and positive and everything, and a newspaper is 99% together, as is the TV news, then that creates a stress between what we want to do as an individual disciple of Christ and the requirement for informed citizenship. So somewhere along the line, a person has to become very discerning as to how much of his informed citizenship to take on so that you don't destroy your own inner attunement to seeking that which is positive.
As a non-theologian, I would hesitate in my own understanding of what it is that I'm called to do as a disciple to say that I'm not called to look long and hard at the evil. I mean, my problem with the mass media is that they don't help us do that enough. That they don't help us understand and look deeply enough at the evil in the world. We're not called to avoid that. We're called to get right into that. And my problem with the media is not that they lead us that way, but that they don't lead us far enough.
Is that your problem with the church, that it doesn't lead us? But we don't lead each other into those discernments, those questions that the media wants us to avoid?
I think we're all comfort junkies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a couple of things. I think a couple different things going on. One is the access to the information and the evidence and how you interpret, how you deal with the information. A couple of things. I am increasingly more and more worried about not the inverted pyramid but the regular one, because I find in the areas that I understand things about, say Central America, an extreme amount of what's called news is actually editorializing under the guise of news. I mean, it has very little concrete information. It's just as a repeating kind of editorializing. And now that Nicaragua has revealed itself to be a Marxist state, what's the information in that? That's pure editorial, but I read that time and again in the news column. But the other thing I think is a very difficult in the U.S. society is our extreme individualism in how we digest things. We all do it as individuals for the most part. We may do it occasionally with our families, but very rarely do we react as communities of faith or communities of discernment, whatever, of taking the news seriously and working with it as people. And the contrast I have that is my experience with the base Christian communities in Central America, where they take news very seriously. And, you know, I mentioned last week, I was talking to some people, the example we went out to this community on the backwaters in Nicaragua, where within 2 days they were already as a community analyzing Reagan's latest foreign policy speech that most of us Americans had not even heard about. And they were taking very seriously, but they do it as a community. They take the news, they sit down, they treat it seriously together. And I think the shared insights that we get past all this stuff that with our reduce our comfort level and our individualism, we just never get past.
It seems to me that the media, in fact, is a reflection of American society and American values, and that much more attention should be given to what are or to look critically at American values. And I certainly would agree. I think that there's not very much sense of community. And instead, Americans have prided themselves on their individualism and on things like freedom and rights for an individual. And I think American civilization stands out in the world community as being particularly unique for this kind of sense that Americans have and are almost incapable of getting outside of that and trying to look at it. And I think if you're talking about American media, it's a very good expression of this sort of thing.
Is the American media getting worse or staying about the same or getting better in terms of informing the public?
Well, I think there are some very good things about the American media, but why does America not produce an equivalent to a BBC, for example, or a Manchester Guardian? I think it's because American values do not lead to that kind of sense of collectivity. And I think that the media is very much controlled by free enterprise capital. And any time that there's a collective or a suggestion of collective good, it's dissipated because of this firm commitment to rights of individuals to make money. And the whole system is influenced by that. And it's reinforced, I think, by individuals, because that's the American way.
One alarming feeling of myself is the increasing lack of interest in citizenship and the demise of politics, and so that we're not encouraging young people to consider this professionally, who have the kind of values which would raise some of the fundamental moral issues and human issues. And I find that frightening.
Well, even the way you just phrased it is interesting, right? That politics is a profession to us now. It's not a calling at all. It's a real practice, right?
A practice, yes.
I mean, we should be. This is a democracy, small d, isn't it?
Yes.
Are we all called into that? Not as a profession, but as a citizen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that is a possible interpretation, the media as a reflection of the individual kind of biases in American culture. I'm not absolutely convinced of that, but it certainly is. It seems to me absolutely central to our conversation here to end this discussion not with a period, but a comma, at most, and to remember how incredibly new it is in a society that we have the capacity to be inundated continually by information, however filtered, that is global in character. I mean, we have no idea how to construct a society, let alone how to be citizens in such a society that has that kind of capacity. We have no idea. This is an area that is just ripe for excitement and invention. I mean, people ought to be terrifically excited about the prospects of reconstructing a society in this sort of a context. And I get discouraged when I see people getting discouraged. Right? About that possibility. It is so new.
Should I put in a commercial for poetry? There are other things to read besides the newspaper, and poetry do put you in touch with reality.
We want to pick up on this tomorrow, because I think we, as I said at the outset, we want to find the threads that go through the conversations that we have individually with one another, and through the seminars that we have, and then bring them together in a community such as this. As Dan says, begin to discern what it is that's bubbling up, so that we could go away from here more active citizens. And, you know, maybe tomorrow night Bill can, you know, give us some of the working definitions that you have of what it means to be a citizen. Does it mean just to vote? Or does it mean something more than that? And if it's something more than that, are there forces outside of ourselves without becoming conspiratorial who don't want us to do that? Who want to manage us, control us, keep us informed? So we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you, Tony.